schematically was like this. We took some propagators, we converted into a proper time integral. Then we Fourier transformed and we expressed the green function as a quantum mechanics path integral. Which was really then written so for our final expression was the path integral over the embeddings of our world line into space-time and onto a metric or a one bane on your world line. Modulo diffeomorphisms, reparametrizations of your world line. So there was some maps X of U, which was a position in space-time. And there's some diffeomorphisms, which are reparametrizations of the variable U. We did it for a massive particle. You can do it in the same way for a massless particle. And actually, if you know how to do the massless particle, you can get the massive particle by dimensional reduction, just by saying, OK, I have one of the directions. I fix the momentum in that direction to be some m. Now, I would like to do similar steps for a Dirac propagator. And the final answer will look like a supersymmetric version of that integral. We'll find out that in order to express the gamma matrices in a convenient way, it's natural to add some extra fermions living on the world line. And in the same way, in order to get this propagator, it's natural to introduce both a metric and something fermionic similar to a metric, which is called a gravitino. And that we'll obtain something which has a gauge symmetry, which is larger than usual diffeomorphism. Together with it, there will be diffeomorphisms, and there will be some fermionic version of the diffeomorphism. So somehow, just in trying to find the world line formalism for a free fermion, massless fermion, you end up with something that is with a very simple example of a supersymmetric theory. Somehow, just in order to describe a fermion in space-time, you end up with a theory which has supersymmetry on the world line. So that's part of the reason I want to work out this example in detail, because presumably you encounter supersymmetric quantum field theories at some point, or maybe you have already encountered them. And this is a nice example. OK, so what is the relationship between gamma matrices and fermions? Well, suppose that I have a quantum mechanics with some fermionic variables. So besides our usual xp equal to I, say that I also have some psi some fermionic variables. When you quantize them, you get naturally an anticommutator like that, which means that once you treat them as operators in your quantum mechanics, they essentially behave like gamma matrices. So So this sort of thing comes out of a Lagrangian that is like x dot squared, roughly. Something like that can come out of Lagrangian, which is something like psi, psi dot. Actually, a better way to think about this is that, well, okay, fine, doesn't matter. So, the first step in our analysis is to write this propagator in some sort of exponentiated form. We know how to get 1 over p squared by integrating it to the minus tau of p squared. In order to get something in the numerator, it's natural to do a Grassmann integral. So this p mu gamma mu can be written as over p squared, can be written as an integral over the tau the zeta of e to the minus p squared tau minus p mu. I can put the gamma mu here, but then oh. Let me write it like that. Because when I do the tau integral, that gives me 1 over p squared. I do the zeta integral, that gives me p mu psi mu. At the moment, these psi are just defined as gamma matrices, essentially, some operators which satisfy these anti-commutation relations.
So the zetas are fermions?
Hmm?
The zetas are fermions?
Yes. So zeta is a fermion, tau is a boson. So tau is a proper time. Can talk about z, you can put call zeta a super time proper. Okay. Now, if I'm in some quantum mechanics, in the same way as e to the minus p squared tau is a sort of a Green function for quantum mechanics like this. Just because the Hamiltonian is just p squared. In a similar way, I can introduce an operator q that I can call sp mu gamma psi mu. And write this as sort of a Green function for the Hamiltonian and this other funny operator. So what this I mean that when this acts on the ground state, it will act on ground in this, or this on a state of this quantum mechanics, not a ground state. When this acts on a grain, on a state of this quantum mechanics, momentum p, it will act precisely in this way. So what I really should say is that this equals the expectation value on a state of this. I'm putting just momentum labels on these states. But the states are also acted upon by these gamma matrices. So these states will carry some spinor indices. These are the states of this Dirac particle that I'm building up. And when Fourier transform to position space, the Green function in position space. Will be something like that, computed in position space. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, what's psi?
Psi is, at the moment, is defined like this. So just some operators that anti-commute, let's say, with gamma matrices, and act on these states. You can make them fully explicit by just writing them as gamma matrices and writing this as a column vector. Or you can leave them a little bit more abstract as the result of quantizing some degrees of freedom with this Lagrangian. See, we're trying to convert this into a path integral over for some quantum mechanics. So we're doing it by writing as integral over tau and zeta of a Green's function, of an expectation value in this quantum mechanics. And then this expectation value can be converted to a path integral. But first, I want to discuss a little bit these operators. What are the properties of these two operators? Well, the main property is that if you square Q, you get the Hamiltonian. So if I think about this as generating some symmetry, this generates some symmetry which is fermionic, but squares to time translations. You can ask yourself how these symmetries act, say, on this Green's function. You see that acting with A, what I want to say is that suppose that, for example, I take a derivative respect of tau of this. That's the same as inserting an extra factor of H. Now, you might think that inserting a factor of Q is the same as taking the derivative respect of zeta. That's actually not quite true. So if you write down what that expression really means, so the expression is e to the minus tau h, 1 minus zeta q. So if you do the zeta of this expression, you just get minus q e to the tau minus tau h hat. If you want to get, on the other hand, if you do zeta dt, then of this expression, then you get zeta the tau, sorry. Get zeta h to the minus tau h, and the zeta square is 0. So I just get this. Okay. So but this is also q squared. So here I should have put a 2. Here, 2. So this is also zeta, it's also q hat, zeta q e to the minus tau h. So the final result is that if I do something like the zeta minus zeta the tau, that's the same as inserting q hat. Now, this had to be the case because we know that Q hat squares to the Hamiltonian. I just said the zeta squared is not something that squares to the Hamiltonian, it squares to zero. But this object squares to this. Because when you square this object, you get the anticommutator between zeta and d over d zeta, which is 1. And let's leave to d over dt. So this is how we encounter the notion of supertranslation. So if we imagine that this Green's function represents a propagation somehow along some time and some super time, then the Hamiltonian corresponds to something that shifts time. Supercharge shifts both time and supertime in this particular way. So the sort of expression is ubiquitous when you study supersymmetry. So typically, so now, in order to get something like this, we would like to generalize this sort of translations to more general coordinate transformations. We would like to set up things so that we don't just use time, but we can parameterize our word line in any way we want. At the same time, we presume we will have to be able to redefine zeta in some way, because translations in the coordinate, the tau coordinate and the zeta coordinate are tied up together. So we need to learn how to define a fermionic version of coordinate redefinitions, which is somehow compatible with the structure. So there is a convenient way to do that, which is to introduce a third operator, which is called the superderivative. Oh, okay, sorry. First of all, let me introduce name for our local coordinates. So I'm going to introduce u and theta. So where u is going to be some bosonic parameter and theta some fermionic parameter on our word line. It should be sort of the generalizations of tau and zeta. So that in our path integral, everything will be a function of u and theta. So which transformations of u and theta could I call super diffeomorphisms? That's what I want to find. I want to find some transformations which will behave in a way similar to this.
Is the anticommutator over there proportional to delta mu because we're in the Green space, or will that generally be theta mu?
Sorry, yes. I meant delta mu.
But in the Green space, it will just be delta mu.
That's right. So, even here, you could have noticed that if I look at something like the zeta plus zeta dt, the tau, this actually anticommutes with the zeta minus zeta, the tau, I think. This two? No, sorry. What am I trying to say? No, sorry, let me forget about this for a moment. Let me just write something, and then it will become clear why it's useful. Okay. So I need to find a group of transformations with some nice property that will remind me of, which behave more or less like that. The easiest way to define a group is a symmetry of something. So instead of defining the group right away, I want to define something whose symmetries are that group. And it turns out that a good candidate for this something is this operator. The property that squares to the u derivative. Pretty much because a way to understand diffeomorphisms is that there are transformations which under which the derivative is multiplied by a Jacobian. So I will look now for transformations with a property that this superderivative is multiplied by some fermionic version of a Jacobian. So let's look at the most general fermionic transformation I can write down. Could look at the most general one, but let me just look at. So let me just introduce some transformation. Okay. Now this is the analog of this supertranslation. And I just put a generic function of u in front of it. So this is what my attempt to generalize the supersymmetric translation to supersymmetric diffeomorphism. We can check if this has a good behavior. Well, one good thing is that if I do the anticommutator of v with the theta derivative, well, I will pick something when this is commuted across this theta, and something when this u picks anticommutes for this. So it turns that this is what you get. Now let me look at this for. I'm sorry, I forgot if I made a mistake here or. I need 3 seconds. Ah, no, right. So, yes, so let's do the calculation step by step and verify this. So, what happens? There is a variety of terms. Today I want to do calculations in detail. So I have this anticommuting with the theta that this gives zero. Anticommuting with theta the u. And I also have the u commuting with f because today I will get all the signs wrong. Okay. And then so this term only gives you something interesting when anticommuted for this or this. Okay, sorry. I really need to do it step by step. So I want to compute the anticommutator between f of u, the theta minus theta the u, together with the theta plus theta the u. Okay. So this anticommutator with the theta only picks theta. So this is going to give me something like f of u the u. Then there is this, which can anticommute with several parts of this expression in an interesting way. the u derivative can pick f, for example. So this will give me something like theta f prime the theta plus theta the u. And then the theta derivative can pick this theta. And here is where, okay. And this gives me an f, the u again. And I surely get the wrong sign, but I think there is a minus here. So these two terms, if the calculation is done properly, cancel out. Because I have a theta here, it doesn't really matter what I have here. This theta squared is 0. So I could have called this a minus. So in general, I could obtain something that has both the theta here and the u. But instead, the u part cancels out, and I'm only left with the d theta part. So this particular form of a symmetry is a symmetry of this differential operator. Now, what if I tried to do a more general transformation? A more general transformation I could have done would have been something like a u du the theta plus b of u theta du. Okay. So if I had done the anticommutator of this with the theta, I would not have had this cancellation because I would have gotten a du from the theta catching this. I would have gotten an a du, but I would have gotten a b du. Sorry, a b du. So the most general coordinate transformations which mixes theta and u, and it's odd, it's something like this. But that's not what we're looking at. We're going to look at a special subset of coordinate transformations, which take this, which has this combination inside, which is analogous to this. And a way to recognize why are they interesting is that they transform this differential operator in a nice way.
That second term is 0, could be just written it as f dot theta partial theta?
Sorry? Here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could have. So doesn't matter. But the crucial point is that there is no du on the right-hand side. There's only a theta d theta. So a final way to think about this, I have a u derivative and a theta derivative. A generic coordinate transformation mixes them up in a generic way. But we're looking at special transformations, we sort of preserve a linear combination of them. Okay. Now, after we discover what are the good fermionic transformations, we can discover what are the good bosonic transformations just by taking anticommutators of true fermionic transformations. So I can compute Vf and Vg. Okay, it's a sort of tedious calculation, but it has two terms. There is an Fg du. And then there is something like f g dot plus f dot g. Dots indicate derivative with respect of u. Theta d theta. So I can write this as sort of a diffeomorphism with generator f g. So I discovered how to do bosonic transformations. So bosonic transformations are the usual thing proportional to the u, augmented by a theta derivative. So you see, if this is a constant, we get the usual, we get the usual translations. If it's not a constant, we get a correction. Again, how do we figure out this correction? This correction is such that this behaves well when it anti-commutes with this, with the theta, when it commutes to the theta. So this transformation preserves this operator simply because Jacobi, right? I can compute L of Fg commutator with the theta simply by writing it as Vf Vg commutator with the theta, and then using the Jacobi identity. Again, I will never get the signs right, but I think yes, I should be getting Vg the theta commutator Vf plus the theta Vf commutator Vg. Not sure there are maybe there are minuses. Okay, I never remember them, but. So you get g dot theta, the theta commutator with Vf plus f dot theta, the theta commutator with Vg. And so then when we have acts on g dot theta, I'm going to get some g dot. I guess it's not immediately obvious that this is still proportional to the theta. Oh, no, sorry, it is, because, of course, when this commutes to this, this anti-commutes will give you something proportional to the theta. When this anti-commutes to this, there will be the theta there left behind. So whatever we get, we'll have the theta here. So this is our definition of the super diffeomorphism, so the fermionic version of diffeomorphisms. They are the combination of these transformations and these transformations. As you see, they reduce for constant parameters to these translations and super translations. And it turns out they are the correct way to set up this problem, and they're the correct way to think about superstring theory later on. I know this, there is no way to make this familiar, unfortunately. Superspace is always coming from above in some bizarre way. There is always almost a nice geometric way to think about it, but never quite all the way.
Will that be a commutator or an anti-commutator?
Here, yeah. It was a commutator because this is bosonic and this is fermionic. Now, something else, a nice feature of these transformations is that the measure, the u, the theta, behaves relatively well. It behaves in the opposite way as the theta on the transformation. So if you do something like this, is invariant. See, I mean, if you just you can just evaluate this expression. it becomes essentially a total derivative. Well, okay, that doesn't matter. Sorry, that's not right. I don't want to consider expressions like this because they're actually total derivatives. What I mean to say is that whatever Jacobian supersymmetric version of the Jacobian you get here when you do the transformations is the opposite as what you get in front of the theta. So well, we're not going to use it today, and actually I don't know why I mentioned it. But I mentioned it because often when you have supersymmetry, you can get a lot of mileage by using superspace. Always think in terms of u and theta, and thinking about every function, every operator, every field as functions of this supersymmetric or these super coordinates. It's an art, and I'm not very skillful with that art. So the alternative way is to use these superspaces as a way to figure out the transformations of your basic objects and then just work with those transformations. So in principle, I could try to write down now the action for the superparticle in superspace. I could really try to write it as an integral over theta and x and u or some functional of some fields of theta and u. But instead, I do things a bit by hand. What do I mean with that? Suppose that has some function y of u and theta greater than x of u plus theta psi of u. Then these diffeomorphisms, super diffeomorphisms, act on this function in the following way. Vf of y is essentially by definition, it's something like f of u the y over the theta, which is psi, minus f of u x dot theta, which comes from this. Okay. But that means that in components, v of f acts on x and maps it to f of u psi of u. And v of f acts on psi by mapping it to f of u x dot u. So this transformation sends position to psi and psi to momentum, roughly. So what I was trying to say is that, and I say it poorly, is that at this point, I could try to write my action as an integral in the u, the theta, or some super Lagrangian build out of y of u and theta by taking super derivatives of this object and doing things with it. It's probably going to look like something like the theta y squared, or something like that. It can be done. For supersymmetric theories, it's not that bad. But here, I'm trying to also introduce a metric. So I'm describing something that is called theory of supergravity. Theories of supergravity are really an art. Trying to think about them in superspace is very tricky. So instead, what I'm going to do, I'm going to take these transformation rules and just focus on this. I'm going to forget about this beautiful supergeometry and keep going in a more pedestrian way. So I'm going to start from the standard action for x. And trying to figure out how to make it invariant under these transformations, step by step. So when I do my transformation of S of X, right? At each step, of course, I will have to figure out how to transform the metric to make things sensible. So here I'm going to get the u, integral over the u of something like 2 e to the minus 1 x dot f dot psi plus f psi dot. This comes from the variation of x. And then I'm going to get the variation of e, which I don't know anything about yet. X dot squared. Next, I'm going to add a fermion, Lagrangian. As I mentioned, I want a psi psi dot so that the quantization will give those anti-commutation relations for the psi. And I can ask, okay, how does this transform? Well, I get the variation of psi I'm going to rearrange the terms a little bit for future convenience. As you saw, when you vary psi, you get x dot. When you vary psi dot, you're going to get the derivative of this. Now, as you see, things are starting to look almost OK. Example, this term is going to cancel this. So if I was just looking at constant transformations, this would be the sum of these two actions would be just OK. So if I didn't diffeomorphisms, but just take F to be a constant. It would be very simple to write down a supersymmetry action. It would be just x dot squared plus psi psi dot. The variation of x dot squared would just cancel against the variation of psi psi dot in a neat way. Here, because we're looking at diffeomorphisms, we get all sorts of derivatives in our parameter. When we study usual diffeomorphisms, the derivative of the parameters are canceled by the variation of the metric. So here we can try to do the same, but it turns out that it's not quite enough and that we need a third piece to the action, a coupling to something that's called the gravitino, a fermionic partner of the metric. So you sort of can see a pattern here, right? You either have x dot square, you have psi psi dot, maybe you can have something like x dot psi, and the gravitino.
There's no theta in the
value? No. So as I said, I could in principle try to do things like this, but in supergravity it's really tough. Okay. You'll need to be a supergravitist to do that.
Your measure just has u in it, which is.
That's right. Instead, I'm just gonna derive from this geometric perspective these transformations. Once I have these transformations, I just proceed by hand. Okay, so if I just look at the variation of this this last term, I get So the role of the gravitino will be just to soak up the terms which have a derivative of f. Okay? So the gravitino is something that compensates for position dependence of your super diffeomorphisms. So it turns out that all of this adds up to zero if we allow the gravitino to transform like this. I could probably write it in a better way. Yeah, maybe I should write it like this.
Is that the same as Fiat?
Sorry, yes. So the gravitino is introduced to take care of the fact that our diffeomorphisms are position dependent. And our metric, and then the metric transforms into the gravitino. So probably if I, you know, if I was able to think about the geometry of superspace better, I would have introduced some sort of a super one bane, which is something like E plus theta chi, okay, and use it to build a super action like this. And maybe next year I'll try to do that, but this year I didn't get around to. Okay, so yeah, this sort of painful step-by-step checks of cancellations is essentially what a lot of supergravity is about. Meaning, at some point in the 80s or 90s, people did these calculations for a whole bunch of theories, found those supergravities, and then once you know that they exist. Once you know that they're supersymmetric, you can use them for all sort of things. But the original proof that they exist and you can and the Lagrangian is invariant is usually very very cumbersome. Anyway, so we have an action. The sum of these three terms is what goes in this path integral. And now we need to check if it's really true that we can gauge fix away the metric and the gravitino to go back to something like that, and then finally reproduce our our Dirac propagator. Again, I understand it clearly looks like a big overkill, you know, if your proof was to produce the Dirac operator. But when you look at superstring theory, it's given just by Fiat with all of this structure, essentially. And it's useful to understand where the structure came from. So in a sense, our purpose at the moment is to build a string theory which has fermions, because bosonic string did not have fermions. And so putting this sort of machinery on the worksheet will make it so that the particles that come out of the string can possibly have Dirac propagators. Now, these transformations are kind of ugly, but they have some nice feature. Up to some sign mistakes that are still haunting me and that I'm not 100% sure about. If you look at the variation of something like e squared chi, and here I must have made a sign mistake of some sort. You find it's a total derivative. The precise power here, I might have gotten wrong in this calculation. It might have been that, okay, but you can sort of see that this can happen if you put the correct power of, oh, okay. Yes, let me just find it here. Okay. I'm sorry. Ah, no, yes, of course. No, okay, I got it. This was correct. I should trust my calculation a bit more. See, if I put E squared inside, the variation of E will pop up another gravitino. Chi squared is 0. So that also implies this, which means if I take the integral of E squared chi, it's going to be invariant under changes of, it's going to be invariant under diffeomorphisms, because the variation is the total derivative. And so this is analogous, is a fermionic version of the length of the word line. And I will identify it with beta. And in a similar way, you can define the usual tau. So essentially, we can gauge fix E squared chi to be zeta and E to be tau, inverse to be tau. Sorry, E to be tau. So fixing the gravitino to a specific form fixes completely the diffeomorphism invariant, the super diffeomorphism invariant. Fixing the metric fixes the bosonic part of the diffeomorphisms. And if you look at this action with constant E and constant chi, you end up precisely with the thing written on the blackboard on top. Because you get x dot squared, which gives you an Hamiltonian B squared. You get this, which is just a first order action. The only effect is to give you anti commutation relations psi psi. And you get this, which is just Q, is P psi, Q zeta. Sorry, maybe I should put a tau square here. Whatever. So this path integral after gauge fixing is going to give us the desired propagator. So this was a bit of a lengthy motivation, but it sets up the basic ingredients to describe the superstring theory. So here, in order to get a Dirac propagator, we made our particle into, describe our particle to a super quantum, supersymmetric quantum mechanics, a quantum mechanics which is extra Q supersymmetry, for a particle moving in normal space-time. So space-time has, we have not touched natural space-time, okay? These Ys are really, can be really taught as literally as maps from our super world line into the normal space-time. I didn't do anything fancy to space-time. So in a similar way, we can think about taking Bauchy theory and making it supersymmetric, taking our Polyakov action and try to make it supersymmetric. So to have a worksheet with coordinates u1 and u2, and maybe theta 1 and theta 2. Okay. And writing down a Polyakov action, or some supersymmetric version of the Polyakov action, involving our usual axis and some size. So I think y is x plus sort of theta I psi I. And maybe the metric. And some partner for the metric, some gravitino. And using the technologies developed in supergravities, you can write a sort of supergravity two-dimensional action, which has these ingredients, is invariant under some super diffeomorphisms, which are much like this. It's tedious and it's not particularly useful, but the result, so this action turns out to have wild symmetry again, and to have a supersymmetric version of wild symmetry. So there will be some path integral using this action over metrics and gravitinos, modulo diffeomorphisms and super diffeomorphisms, and wild transformations and super wild transformations. And there will be some big gauge fixing. And all of these symmetries are just enough to fix the metric and the gravitino to some specific forms. So in the bosonic case, once you fix the form of the metric, you are only left with holomorphic coordinate transformations. Remember? So our final worksheet is covered by coordinate patches, each of which has the flat metric related by holomorphic coordinate transformations. The end point of this story is some sort of a super holomorphic thing, something where you have some coordinates where the metric is flat and the and gravitino is zero. Okay. And different coordinate patches are related by super holomorphic coordinate transformations. The super holomorphic coordinate transformations are literally this when you replace u with z. So there is a z and a theta, and maybe some z bars and theta bars. And they transform to z prime, theta prime, which depend holomorphically on this. And infinitesimally, the transformation take the form. So at the end, all of these complications sort of are distilled into a sort of straightforward generalization of the usual bosonic string setup. Instead of integrating of an integral over the space of complex structures on your human surface, you have an integral over some space of supersymmetric complex structures. And of course, you will have to have ghosts of all sorts, because you have gauge fixed a lot of stuff. There will be usual ghosts for the diffeomorphisms. And there will be some other ghosts, which are bosonic, which are the ghosts for this super diffeomorphisms. There will be a stress tensor in the story, but there will also be a supercurrent. So the stress tensor is the variation with respect to the metric. The supercurrent is the variation with respect to the gravitino. The modes of the stress tensor and the modes of the gravitino, of the supercurrent, will be used in defining what states are on shell, what states are BRST closed, what states are BRST exact. If you remember, the on-shell condition in the bosonic string just came from L0, from the zero model of the stress tensor. That set p squared equal to something. Now the zero model of the gravitino, of the supercurrent, when available, will give you the Dirac equation. Inside here, there will be something that looks like psi contracted with p equal to zero, where the psi behave like gamma matrix. All of this structure will make sense only if the theory is actually valid invariant. So there will be some calculation to be done to compute the Weyl anomaly. There will be the usual 26 here, but there will be a contribution from the super ghosts, which is something like plus 11. And then we have our scalar fields, which contributes 1, and the fermions, it contributes 1/2. So the Weyl anomaly will cancel if 3/2 times the number of dimensions of space-time minus 15 equal to 0, which means that the dimension of space-time will be 10. So this is how these superstring theories will typically live in 10-dimensional space-times. Now, at various steps of the construction, there are some choices to be made. For example, it turns out that you can introduce theta and theta bars, but you can also just introduce thetas and not theta bars. It looks strange to have a coordinate and not its complex conjugate. But for Grassmann variables, it can be done. And if you do that, you get something called a terotic string. In the terotic string, sort of the left telomorphic part behaves like superstring theory. The anti-telomorphic part behaves like bosonic string, but still manages to be well-defined.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry?
Can we add more super charges in order to change the dimension?
It's funny. So on the left-hand side, on the holomorphic side, the calculation is identical. You still have 10 dimensions. But now you're missing some central charge in the anti-holomorphic side. And you compensate it by adding some extra degrees of freedom that are only right. Only purely anti-holomorphic degrees of freedom.
Can we add more supersymmetries, more supercharges?
On the worksheet, sure. You could also try to have two thetas, two holomorphic thetas, two anti-holomorphic ones. These are called n equal 2 strings. Typically, so they're nice because they live in 4 dimensions. They're not nice because the signature of space-time has to be either 4, 0, or 2, 2. Somehow, n equal 2 supersymmetry forces you to pair up your scalar. So they're not Lorentz invariant. They're usually not studied very much.
But we can get a smaller dimension if we add that n equals 2 supersymmetry.
Yes, that's right. Because then you have even more ghosts of the beta gamma type. And the dimension goes farther down. OK, so Do you have any questions? I know it's a bit of a wild ride with the.
So if you have one theta, we would call that n equals one supersymmetry. So the n is the number of thetas, roughly?
Roughly. There is no coherent naming convention. But typically, n equal one is the minimum amount. To be precise, you need to, in two dimensions, you need to specify how many holomorphic ones and how many anthropomorphic ones you have. So the proper name would be something like 1,1 here. In fact, the trade of this is 1,0, and so on.
Is there some other way to introduce fermions apart from supersymmetry in string?
Pretty much when you on the watch, well, let me see. I mean, there are other formulations of the same string theory, like the Green-Schwarz formulation. In the Green-Schwarz formulation, you don't put supersymmetry on your on the watch sheet. But you add extra direction, extra fermionic directions in space-time. So here, somehow, we haven't, all the work supersymmetry we have added was on the watch sheet. In principle, space-time does not need to be supersymmetric. It will turn out to be supersymmetric. But just because when we compute the spectrum of this theory, it ends up having a gravitino in the target space. And so it is it turns out to be supersymmetric. But it, yeah, watch sheet supersymmetry definitely makes things a little bit more complicated. For example, when you do loop calculations, you need to figure out what is the correct moduli space for these super symmetric Riemann surfaces, super Riemann surfaces. And initially in the 80s, people sort of did things a bit by hand, trying not to think too much about super Riemann surfaces. And recently, Witten had cleaned up a lot of those old derivations by giving more beautiful geometric interpretation. Not only Witten, Witten, Sen, and others. But yes, I don't know of any clean way to get rid of the supersheet supersymmetry in superstring theory. And it's actually a big stumbling block because. So in these supersymmetry theories, there are a lot of fields, right? Masses fields. And in principle, we should be able to study string theory in backgrounds in which any of these massless or these fields has been turned on, the same way as you can study string theory in a non-trivial gravitational background. But it turns out that some of those fields try to break down your watch sheet supersymmetry when you turn them on. And so this is the ground that we call Ramon backgrounds. That makes it impossible to use this formalism to describe situations where those fields are turned on. For example, in ADS-CFT, on the string side of ADS-CFT, those fields are turned on, so we cannot use this formalism. We cannot do easily, in this formalism, direct calculations on the ADS side. Holography would be probably immensely more powerful if you knew how to deal with this problem. You know, to do things like finding the string theory holographic dual to Jan-Mills theory, at some point we'll have to deal with this.